Hiya, and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. My name's Brooke, and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Hi, I'm Ashwini, and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
Thank you for returning to listen to part two of this interview.
And I think it is still a real shame that most people who don't work in brain injury don't really know what a brain injury looks like, though there is the statistic that every 90 seconds somebody is admitted to hospital with a brain injury.
Is that worldwide or is that?
In the UK.
UK, wow.
Yeah. So that could be concussions and
yeah.
You know, there is a lot of people out there who've got brain injuries to varying degrees. And I think we still don't really know as a society what that looks like.
I suppose so as well, and we've discussed this previously, that you see a brain injury, you see a brain injury, yeah, and everyone presents differently. So there's that element, it's the hidden disability element, and you know, it's not as obvious, you know, as opposed to somebody who's, say, missing a limb, but it's the impact is huge, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, the number of people who I've met with brain injuries have said it would have been easier to lose a limb because people would have understood that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if I was in a wheelchair, people would understand that.
Yeah.
People can't see how exhausted.
There's also, you don't understand it as well.
So yeah.
You're trying to explain something that you don't fully understand yourself. So
the amount of times I've dealt with family members or other people associated to clients where it's like, well, you know, but they're out of hospital, they're better, why aren't they better now?
Yeah.
And it's kind of trying to explain that it doesn't work that way. Yeah. It's a brain injury, it affects the brain permanently.
There's a really interesting video with Richard Hammond and Stirling Moss. And Stirling Moss also had a brain injury from racing. And Richard Hammond was talking about, he was saying, I look back and I thought I was okay then, but I realised there were still problems, but I'm okay now. And then 6 months later, he would look back and say, oh, Jim, I thought I was okay then. But and that kind of...
really relates to that. Someone bought me, that's a similar time as Richard Hammond had his injury in 2006 and my mum's in 2007. I think he'd got the book out when I was in hospital or very soon after, and somebody bought me it to read in hospital. And I remember trying to read it, like, I had double vision. I was reading it through one eye.
Yeah.
And, you know, you read five lines, forget what you've just read and stuff. It was, I think I could got through it, but yeah, I don't remember any of it.
I'll see if I can find a link for that video that you mentioned. If we can find it, we can certainly put it on the footnotes, because I think that would be quite interesting to see, especially as you say, if it's sort of every 6 months, how that insight changes. But yeah, actually things are still not...
You don't see yourself every day though, do you?
No.
I mean, sorry, you do see yourself every day, so you don't...
You don't see the progress.
Yeah, because I think Richard Hammond was initially saying that everything's the same. I like celery now or I don't like celery. There's something about celery.
Yeah.
And that was his only issue. But obviously, you know, he very publicly went on his journey, you know, which I think sometimes we don't give celebrities the confidentiality they need around their injuries.
No, I mean, I suppose it's double-edged sword in a way, in the sense that, yeah, he should be allowed to have that privacy, but then if he's chosen to, and actually it can sometimes help to put that spotlight on, for the reason that we were saying before, that people don't understand brain injuries. So having somebody in the celebrity sphere who says, actually, I've had a brain injury and this is how it's affecting me, might then help other people to go, oh, yeah, okay, I understand that, you know, you might find it harder to do this or to remember that.
Yeah, I've got a lot of respect for the celebrities that do sort of share their difficulties. I suspect maybe earlier on we should be a little bit more protective, my thoughts.
Yeah, but I suppose he made that decision, so.
But had he got capacity?
Well, let's get into that minefield. Another thing that I wanted us to cover is just, and I think this has been covered with you, Brooke, I think, in season one, about, you know, the importance of pacing yourself and not trying to run before you can walk. And
just still mess up on.
I think, it's natural as human beings, I think, that we want to get somewhere, you know, but I think particularly following a brain injury. And, you know, someone, I see it time and time again with clients where they just want to get back to work. That, and more often than not, that is a primary driver. I just want to get back to work, as if you can just walk into work tomorrow and pick up, you know, from where you left off, log in and get on with it. And you'll know that that's not necessarily the case. And I'm sure when you hear that, there's probably a bit of a wry smile going on, going, okay, let's see. But just talk to us about how you manage your clients and employers through that, in terms of the pacing, the phased return element of it.
Yeah, so I would do a phased return to work, which would be, I'm more of a fan of little and often rather okay. than trying to do longer days. Mm. Some companies already have phased return to work plans, but they're the same whether you've broken your leg or yeah. had a severe brain injury. So somebody who's been off work a long time would need a much slower return to work. But that's not just looking at hours. I think sometimes we look at, oh, well, you do this number of hours, then you increase to this number of hours. There's also looking at the tasks that are involved. So it could be that you're working with supervision. It could be that there's certain tasks you know you can do really well and others that are a bit of a challenge. So we have to increase the tasks as well as the hours. Sometimes there'll be people who can work a lot of hours, but actually they're only doing half the job because they're not doing the full job. So it's important to get that graded return in terms of A, hours, but B, the tasks, and potentially C, the amount of supervision and support that goes along with that.
Do you meet resistance from employees when you said that your preference is little and often, but you might have employees with set plans? Do you meet resistance? Because presumably it does also take a lot for employees, in the sense that, you know, they're, at the end of the day, they're missing somebody's service, yeah, their employment. Yeah. And I imagine there'll be extra resource involved in terms of having a buddy, a mentor, a supervisor working with that person to phase them back in. So it's additional resource on the employer's side. Do you find that employers can be resistant, or are they helpful in that regard?
There's a mixed bag. I've never done any proper research on this, but my gut reaction often is that the people who are really well liked before they had their brain injury are the ones who get support when they go back. So I have had ones where the employees have been a little bit resistant, maybe. And then one of them will say, you know, he wasn't particularly well liked before he had the injury. So when somebody's coming back before they, you know, coming back maybe with social problems and a bit disinhibited, course, yeah. as well. Mm. There is resistance to that. Yeah. But, you know, some employers have been absolutely amazing. And I've had ones that they've already kind of thought about how they can do it and made their plans and really want to support that person.
Yeah.
And again, I think it does go back to what I was saying earlier around, they did get that phone call out of the blue to say their colleague was in intensive care, and they're shocked by that, and they do. Do you want to help?
It comes down to individuals, doesn't it? Yeah. What's that boss like as a person? Is he caring? Is he willing to put the effort in to understand? Yeah. Or is he just want the person back?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose at the end of the day, it's humans, isn't it?
So yeah, very much so.
But you're right. And it's interesting what you're saying there about, you know, I appreciate it's non-official research, but I suppose there is that human inclination to help those that we like, that's one of us or whatever, yeah. and question whether that's actually fair. But, you know, human behaviour is what it is. Can you sort of think of any particular success stories that resonate for you and with all the clients that you've worked with over the years?
There have been people who, you know, have gone back to the original job. So the guy who ran the London Marathon, he ended up going back part-time, but actually worked really closely with his employers, found a job within a slightly modified job. It worked for him, it worked for his family. And, you know, he contacts me every now and then and just sort of lets me know. I discharged him years ago, but, you know, sort of keeps up to date with how things are going. Mm. There was a man as I worked with long time ago who got him, it was a new job, and he's still in that role. And every now and then there is little hiccups, and it's usually around work changing. And,
okay, yeah.
Sometimes go back and offer a little bit of support, but he's been able to maintain that that role.
That's good. So, yeah. And I suppose success doesn't have to be defined by going back to the same job, does it? It can be, as we started off by saying at the beginning of the discussion, about finding something meaningful.
Yeah. I do also think sometimes the sort of the sadder part of my job is supporting somebody to leave a situation with dignity.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes it isn't working, and I do think that is really important to support that person potentially to make a decision to leave and to support through that decision. And it's something that I hate doing, and I normally go home and cry a bit, but it is one of those situations that, again, we often paint the employer as being the bad guy, and often in those situations they're gutted too. So we would normally have some sort of final meeting that they have to have for their legal situation, but you know, they've wanted it to work as well, and sometimes somebody's too injured and it isn't the right environment for them. But I think there is sometimes trying to give that person the feeling that they've had some choice and some control over leaving the work. So on paper that might not feel like a good outcome, but if somebody's been able to leave a situation in a way that's a bit more dignified, I think that is still a success, because it cuts ties and allows them to then move forward. And that could be looking for different work, or it could be filling time with hobbies and voluntary work or other things like that that are positive for that person.
And I guess the benefit of your input there as well is that that exit wouldn't come as a shock. It would be very much a managed process, again, with potentially the input of other therapists in the mix to help support that person with those decisions. But as you say, if it's the right outcome overall, then it's not a failure. It's just a different direction.
Yeah. I think this one of the things that we often look at the cognitive side around brain injury, but we sometimes miss out on the social issues that potentially, and I think employers are actually really happy to support around diaries, but if somebody's quite disinhibited, that can be really quite problematic within a workplace. So one of the things that I often use if I'm doing any sort of training with people is a clip from the film Imitation Game. And I think this is how you know that your life is just got really, really sad. Yeah. When you sit in the cinema and you're watching a film, you think, that's going to be great for training. And it's a bit... it is on YouTube, so you'll be able to link it in the description. But there is a bit where Alan Turing, who, you know, amazing guy who helped develop the Enigma machine, but was, you know, socially quite awkward. And one of his colleagues says, "Oh, we're going for lunch." And he carries on working. And they say, "Alan, we're going for lunch." He carries on working. And they say, "Alan, do you want any lunch?" And this conversation just descends where he's saying, "Oh, what are you having for lunch? Oh, I don't like sandwiches." And it's this whole conversation that they're just almost having two different conversations.
Yeah.
And he said, "Look, you know, we've just asked you three times, do you want to come for lunch?" And Alan Turing says, "No, you didn't."
I'm going
for lunch. And it's that one of those things of just understanding that somebody with a brain injury might find those little subtle bits of conversation really challenging.
Yeah.
In my first job, I used to work in a brain injury rehab unit, and Howard Jackson, who was my boss, used to say what you mean what you say. And that is those silly little things of saying, "I'm going for lunch," rather than "Do you want to come for lunch?" is really important. And that's often where difficulties occur at work, rather than just being the pure cognitive problems, which, you know, is around cognitive inflexibility, isn't it? That somebody wouldn't understand those things. But
And I think, it's interesting, because I think the English language is full of examples, not that I can come up with another one to mind.
But yeah.
We've got so many examples of things where you say one thing, but it has a completely different social meaning. And by and large, people understand that. But when you take somebody who is now thinking in a very black and white, rigid way, I totally see that. And that can then cause friction between people, and unintentionally so. But it becomes harder to manage. And potentially, I wonder whether that could then lead to isolation within the workplace as well.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, you can see people will say, oh, we don't want to say things to him, he'll take it the wrong way. I always think the word fine is one of those things, because fine can mean, fine, or it can mean fine.
Yeah.
They mean very different things.
Oh, yes.
You know, in the second one, things aren't fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but yeah, so those are, I think, often the bigger problems than the cognitive problems that happen within workplaces. And it is just about getting somebody who, I work with a woman, she was volunteering in a cafe, and it was around, it was called like Sandwich Gate, but there was issues because she'd learned how to make a sandwich. And when you're working in a professional environment, they want their sandwiches to be consistent. So the way they made sandwiches was slightly different to how she made a sandwich. And that created a big row, because nobody had actually talked to her about, okay, that's your sandwich and that's fine, but in this workplace, this is how you make our sandwiches. And she felt like she was being attacked, and they felt like she was being awkward. And so it can often be the tiniest of things. But if somebody doesn't understand that person thinks in a really black and white way,
yeah, of course,
then, you know, it appears to be awkward, and it's actually often anything but.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I suppose it's the importance of brain injury education, sorry. Mm. But also someone just perhaps almost objective coming in and just taking that overarching view of what's the process here? What's the missing link? Where is it falling down? And it can be as simple as that sort of tiny chunk of communication that's missing. It's very interesting. And it makes you think how many situations could have been handled differently, how outcomes could have been very different if actually communication was improved.
Yeah.
So I guess you are a communication facilitator as well.
Yes, guru, I think.
So thinking about meaningful employment, meaningful activity, and also the idea that, you know, we've talked about how if you see a brain injury, you see a brain injury, and people are impacted in different ways. So I think Brooks mentioned in the past that, you know, there are certain hours of the day when he's more awake, or, you know, and I also see this as well with certain clients, you know, that you just wouldn't do anything with them in the afternoon, or if they've had if they've had a particularly grueling psychology session or whatever it is, you know, something that might have taken a cognitive toll. And then I suppose you look at that with what somebody's work expectations are, or what their employment requires of them. I guess you'd try and work out when is somebody functioning optimally. And perhaps, Brooke, you can talk to us about some of your experiences.
First of all, something that I've discovered recently is cold showers. As brutal as it is on a morning, 3 minutes in the cold water really, really does wonders for you.
Wow. Wim Hof.
I know.
That's what I tell myself I am when I'm shivering under the cold shower.
Oh, you're tougher than me, Brooke.
Yeah, generally on the morning is the best time. And then I tend to fade towards the end of the day.
Mm.
But, to get me to do anything in the late afternoon is generally, you're not getting much out of me. So it's, I guess, trying to find the best ways you can be employed, because I found that sometimes I can be good and I can be quite creative, but then other times I can be terrible and really affected by my brain injury. And it's finding those best times, and they're not always going to be like to fit in a work schedule. So I think what I did to start with, because I was just bored at home and I wasn't doing anything, was I started writing, and I taught myself to type. My dad bought me ages ago. It was a Mavis Beacon Teaches Typing, and I remembered that, and I downloaded it on the computer, and I did that, and I taught myself to touch type, and I started writing silly things down, writing blogs down and putting them online, and the people started liking them, and that was what I did for the style. But I mean, like, I would do some writing, then I'd just be exhausted, and, you know, I'd come back to it, finish it later. You know, it's like a couple of pages of work would take me, you know, a couple of days to do. And you just think, you'd constantly be comparing yourself to people in like the professional you know, professional sphere, like, you know, how easy it must be for somebody to just sit and write, you know, professional person to sit and write that down, maybe half an hour, and it's taken me 2 days. And that, of course, has an impact on your self-esteem. Then I guess I found I had this idea that I wanted to do public speaking. And the first thing I did was to Headway at Scarborough. And I don't know how many people came, like, I don't know, maybe 30 people came or something like that. But it was, I remember when I'd done it, it just felt really good that I'd actually done something. And like, it was the first time in years I'd actually contributed something and felt really good. And that's something I'd continue to do. And I found that was suiting, because at home there wasn't a rigid schedule that I had to stick to plan this. I could plan it when I wanted. And then, you know, the delivery of the talk itself was only like, what did you used to waffle on? It used to go for an hour and a half sometimes, but it was about, you know, less than an hour. And I remember just, you know, coming back from that. We used to do with the emergency services in North Yorkshire at the start, and coming away from that was really good that I'd contributed something. And, you know, I hadn't put the amount of hours in, but I just thought, you know, I've contributed something. I've spoke to kids about the potential dangers of, you know, potential consequences of driving without due care and attention. So yeah. I did feel good about that.
Yeah, and I just think I'm listening to you talking, thinking, well, actually, public speaking is one of the biggest fears that people have. Mm. So you smashed that.
That was a reason for it. Really, it was just like, what can I do with my life?
And yeah,
I had this limited energy to work with. So what can I do with it?
Yeah, and you know, you say no, it was only about an hour, but actually, an hour of public speaking.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
that's actually really, and notice you're going only this, only that, but actually, you're doing really.
Give yourself more credit.
Yeah, I think sometimes listen to the way you talk to yourself,
which is something my psychologist has
thank yourself more.
Said to me. Be kinder to yourself.
Yeah.
But I think also interestingly, when you're saying about, you know, you're better in the morning than maybe the evening, that's when it is good to look at if people are going back to work, looking at the graded return. So for some people, if they've got a lot of pain and maybe they need to take painkillers and things like that, then an afternoon start or a bit of a later start might be better. If somebody's got a lot of anxiety, then if they start in the afternoon, they just spend all their morning dreading going to work.
So
there is that, actually trying to look at the times,
and
that
right itself can be exhausting as well.
And then, you know, sometimes work isn't, or paid work isn't always the right thing for somebody. So it could be that, you know, you've got skills, you know you want to make a difference, but it could be that you do something. I mean, I have to say, Brute, you've shown amazing initiative. The fact that you started a blog is really good. And, you know, I don't think I just want to go and do some public speaking and then go and carry it out.
And then I'll just run a marathon or two.
Yeah. But, you know, it could be that you find an outlet for yourself, or it could be that you join an organisation. So some people would join different classes. It could be that they go salsa dancing or join choirs. I know you're very into choirs, aren't you, Ashwini? Mm. Or it could be that some people go and find groups associated with the disability, like the local Headway group. Often, or most of the Headway, I think if not all of them, have survivors of brain injury on the committee, so they can help run the group. So there is different ways of contributing that isn't just paid employment. It's volunteering, it's going, having hobbies and interests, doing different things with family.
On that salsa dancing thing, I've been recently trying to learn Argentinian tango.
Wow.
No, it's not. No, you see me dancing Argentinian tango and you would not say well. But I've been going... Obviously, my girlfriend is from Ecuador. She speaks Spanish, so I'm trying to. We were at the Spanish Cervantes in the Spanish Institute on Deansgate in Manchester, and there was like an open day, and there was a guy there doing like tango demonstrations, and I've been learning Spanish, but I just found I'd missed four lessons. It was like two lessons a week. I went on holiday, missed two. And then I come back and I had COVID, so I had to have another week off. So I missed four lessons and I just really struggled to get back to the class after that. So I made a decision to have a bit of a break. But in that time, we decided to go to tango lessons. They were like 6:30 at night, and it was just, you know, people, I suppose people without a brain injury, was it was, you know, they were finishing work and it was a nice thing to do on an evening. But to me, there was like, my brain was exhausted trying to learn these steps. And then you're like, you come the next week and you've forgotten it all. You know, going back to what we did last week, and it was just, yeah, I really sort of struggled with it. So I wasn't quite strictly come dancing, but, you know, but the guy did actually say to me, it was, he'd had some experience of brain injury, and he said there were two of the best things to do for a brain injury is to A, learn a language, and B, learn, well, he said tango, but I guess it's learn dances, learning the steps of something right. that's keeping your brain active. But I suppose it would be better if you had the lessons in the morning.
Yeah.
How are the Spanish lessons going, incidentally?
It was, because of that, I was struggling with it. So I took a break. So I'm on a bit of a sabbatical from it, but I will go back to it. Yeah, I was enjoying it. It was just, I just missed too much out of the lessons. And then you go back and then these people have learned things that you haven't learned. And I'm going to go back to it because I did enjoy it.
Yeah. And I think that does go back to little and often, whereas trying to pick up something on a weekly basis is really difficult. Mm. Whereas if you do shorter periods of regular activity, it
which
helps
why
embed.
I did two lessons a week. So I was doing two Tuesdays and Thursdays. And it was, I was enjoying it until I got behind.
But I suppose it's also finding the balance between little and often to get that habit loading, but also not cognitively overload as well, because, it can be. I suppose it's trial and error in some ways, isn't it? Just finding what the right balance is for somebody.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Suzanne. That's been really interesting. I think both of us have really got a lot out of that discussion, and I'm sure our listeners will have done too. And of course, we will put the links to the resources that we mentioned in the footnotes to the episode. Suzanne, if you've got your social media contact details, by all means, please do.
So I'm on the Twitter, or X as it is these days. So it is SuzGuest, which is SuzGuest. And I'm also on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube as Have I Got Suze For You. So at the moment, my TikTok is full of my sourdough. I've made a sourdough starter and it is my entire personality right now.
I love the handle though, Have I Got Suze For You. I think that's genius.
My website is workingmind.co.uk.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much again for coming in and talking to us today. Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.